This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Dashrin Johan. As we all may have already known by now, the COVID-19 pandemic isn't just a health crisis, but indirectly contributes to a whole host of other issues as well, including the rise of domestic violence and abuse, and this is across the globe. Now, the first MCO in Malaysia saw a sharp surge in domestic violence against women, and 1 year later, and Malaysia is still under various stages of lockdowns, and NGOs have continued to ring the alarm bells, highlighting intensified domestic abuse. So joining me on the show today to give us some updates on the situation this MCO, as well as suggestions on how we can attempt to handle the problem, is Shazana Akha, the head of research at WAO. Welcome to the show, Shazana. How are you doing?
Hi, Lashin. Thank you for inviting us. Glad to be here. Yeah.
All right. So let's do a recap. I know this is something that we've talked about, NGOs have talked about, even we at the station have talked about, but I think perhaps it's worth reminding, given that the topic we are covering. Tell me, what exactly is domestic violence and what constitutes domestic violence here in Malaysia?
So domestic violence refers to a pattern of violence, abuse or intimidation used to control or maintain power over a partner. Could be your spouse, your girlfriend, boyfriend, fiance, or any other family member. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But under the Domestic Violence Act in Malaysia, the partner that we refer to here, it would be your married partner, lah.
Yeah. Right.
So the Domestic Violence Act in Malaysia does not encompass intimate partners, or rather like non-married couples, for instance, boyfriend, girlfriend, fiance, that kind of thing. So domestic violence, as long as the relationship between the perpetrator as well as the survivor, or rather the victim, as long as they have a family relationship, it could be an elderly parent and a son, it could be between two partners, husband and wife. It could be even your ex-spouse. So it could be your ex-husband, you know. So as long as there has been family relationship between the two, then that would be covered under Domestic Violence Act.
Right. Okay, and how has the pandemic worsened domestic violence?
All right. So now, I guess with physical distancing measures in place, survivors are generally forced to be confined at home with their abusers and with less access to their usual support systems. You know, so if they used to go to work regularly and meet friends, that support system is no longer there. If they used to be able to mingle with extended family, that kind of support system is no longer there. With neighbors, you know, so a reduction of social support systems puts the survivor in a very isolated situation. And this gives opportunities to perpetrators to exert their violence and control. Yeah. And I mean, not just this isolation, but we're also talking about the mounting tensions as a result of the COVID, as a result of COVID-19 and MCO, you know.
Right.
So the financial stress, the arrangements, different patterns of arrangement for work, school, having to juggle this, and as well as the additional care work that, you know, usually falls a lot on women. All of these things contribute to increased stress. And although they don't cause domestic violence, they are definitely potential triggers, you know. So I think it's important to kind of highlight here that at the basis of domestic violence is the idea that the perpetrator has in his mind that he has entitlement, or he or she has entitlement to exert violence over the other. So that is the cause of domestic violence. I think that cannot be diluted in any way. But in terms of the triggers, these there are triggers that could cause perpetrators to begin. Okay.
Now, let's, you know, when we talk about the impact of the pandemic on domestic violence, when we zoom in on the latest MCO or, you know, perhaps the last few months, has there been an increase in calls to your hotlines and all to, has there been an indicator that there's been more intense or increasing number of domestic violence cases?
So I think what's interesting, Dashan, is that for every MCO, the patterns are a bit different. So in the first MCO, we definitely saw a fourfold increase in the number of calls and messages to our hotlines, right? For this MCO, there has been a slight increase in numbers, about a 20% increase, yeah? Mm-hmm. So you see that, for instance, in May, we had about 287 calls to our hotline, as well as 289 WhatsApp messages.
May this year.
Yeah, and then in June, we see this increase to 317 calls and 393 WhatsApp messages. Yeah, so you notice a slight increase. And who's to say that this might not increase further as we go along? So as I was saying, Dashan, it's really difficult to anticipate as well, because like in the first MCO, initially we didn't have the increase in numbers, but as we went further into the MCO, the increase became fourfold, you know. But now with this MCO, people are maybe a bit more accustomed to, you know, what an MCO is. Maybe less panic about, you know, what is accessible. So they may not be as drastic as increase as the first MCO, but certainly we are noticing an increase. Dasha, I also want to highlight that since the MCO began, we have had an increase in calls with regards to child abuse and incest. And that numbers have increased consistently or since the MCO began. Yeah. And we also noticed that children and teenagers are calling in more. So they're calling in more to talk about the domestic violence happening within their home. Right.
Okay. So do you anticipate that things will only get worse in the weeks to come?
So it's hard to anticipate, but just to say that in the week before the lockdown started, before MCO started, we had an increase in the number of requests for rescues. You know, survivors are calling to request help to be rescued and to be relocated to different to a safe place. Okay, and that kind of alerted us to the need to be able to respond adequately towards survivors. You know, so as a service provider, we anticipate that things might increase, and so we make arrangements to ensure that our services are available. But we can only tell when the numbers actually come in.
How do you all? Yeah, and that's the thing, right? The lack of data, you know, in Malaysia, it's an issue across the board for regardless of, you know, what the social issue is. It's always a problem, data. But, you know, how do you all anticipate? I'm wondering, you know, what when you all make these observations, what do you all see causes the increase or decrease? Is it the rigidness of the lockdown? Is it the amount of time people spend at home? Whereas when certain lockdowns and people get to go out to work and all, you know, the numbers start to drop. And then when the lockdowns become strict again, the numbers sort of increase. Would you say that's sort of a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's the thing. So I feel, Dashan, at this point, I feel like it's really hard to say, really. It's difficult to come up with something conclusive like that until and unless we really go through the numbers and the patterns and, you know what I mean? In the past 2 years, we haven't been able to come up with a conclusion like that. But certainly, you know, the moment we notice a slight increase in our calls or an increase in, you know, requests for rescues, that those are already signs that, you know, we need to anticipate and we need to make arrangements. So, yeah. And then maybe later we can go look back and analyze, you know what I mean?
Certainly. Yeah. What are some of the specific problems that survivors of domestic violence are facing this time around, perhaps due to SOPs or maybe a lack of robust policies?
So I think we are kind of conscious of the fact that with the MCO in place, there are a lot of different rules and different SOPs, right? With regards to movement, with regards to access to support systems and things like that. So in this particular MCO, we are noticing that there's a lot of there's some ambiguity with regards to survivors being able to travel, right? Mm-hmm. To access shelters, etc. So it's more of this kind of observation. This is our observation during this MCO, and taking our lessons from the previous MCO, the first MCO, where there was a lot of confusion over, you know, access to courts and access to police stations, etc. So taking lessons from that and taking note of the kind of difficulties in this MCO, we are kind of mindful of the fact that we need to really clarify what are the SOPs and, you know, policies with regards to survivors' access to support and protection.
On the show with me today is Shazana Akha, the head of research at the Women's Aid Organization. After the break, I'll be asking her for some recommendations for the government on how they can help manage the rising number of domestic abuse cases. We'll be back on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Shazana Akha, the head of research at the Women's Aid Organization. And we're talking about domestic violence during the latest MCO and what the government can do to manage the situation. So, Shazana, we've talked about the problems that survivors are facing because of the lockdown. So let's dive into some of the perhaps recommendations that WAO might have to, you know, try and manage the situation the best way possible. So in your press release that WAO recently sent out, there were three recommendations. Perhaps you can go through them one by one. So what is your first recommendation?
So our first recommendation is that any SOP changes in the referral pathways or the support pathways for domestic violence survivors must be communicated to all frontline officers as well as the general public. Okay. Mm. So this includes like access to apply for interim protection orders, emergency protection orders, admission to safe places or shelters, a kind of list of government hospitals, or rather one-stop crisis centers, yeah, located at government hospitals. Are they still receiving and operating and accepting survivors? You know, So these are just some things that is kind of important to kind of know, you know, so that survivors can access, know that they are able to access these support systems when they need to during MCO. So whether or not there are changes, we don't know. And that's why we are asking the government, if there are changes, it needs to be clarified.
Okay, so based on your observation and findings, has there been, you said you learned lessons from the first MCO and so on and so forth over the past 1 year. So based on your observation, has there been a lack of clear top-down communication right now?
Yeah, in the first MCO, I think there was that, you know, top-down communication problem. Mm-hmm. You know, what was being said at the higher levels of authority were not, you know, did not translate into what was happening at the ground level, you know. So this was what we noticed in the first MCO, and which is why we are mindful of this and trying to make sure we steer clear of this, you know, path. Yeah.
And what is the impact of this, you know, lack of clear communication, you know, top-down communication? What is the impact towards the survivors of domestic violence?
So when survivors, I guess in the context of a pandemic, right, and MCO, where the priority is to address, you know, COVID-related concerns, social distancing concerns. So you know, when all these become priority, we run the risk of sidelining the concerns and safety of domestic violence survivors. And that's what we don't want to happen, because their safety, even in this context, is of utmost importance, you know. So we don't, when survivors make a report of domestic violence, if they are going to be told that, you know, we can't do it now because it's MCO, you know, these kinds of responses are something that we want to nip in the bud before, you know, so that it doesn't take place.
All right, let's get into your second recommendation. What's your second recommendation?
So a second recommendation is for exceptions to be granted for DV survivors to cross the 10-kilometer boundary for the purpose of accessing police assistance, hospitals, or safe transit centers. You know, and for these to be announced along with the EMCO SOPs. You know, so and this is we can observe this being done in the United Kingdom, where when they make announcements about, you know, lockdown, standard operating procedures, etc., they specifically identify domestic violence survivors as among those who are allowed to travel when the lockdown is enforced, and this kind of communication really helps to make it clear to everyone, not just the public, but to frontline officers themselves, and as well as to perpetrators themselves, you know, so that, you know, the frontliners are clear that, you know, if domestic violence survivors come or come by their way, they are, you know, they should be given some access to travel. Perpetrators are aware that, you know, government is still on the lookout for survivors. Okay, they don't have a free hand of everything. And also, survivors themselves, of course, are able to access this or rather travel with the full confidence that they're not going to be stopped. And, you know, so these are some things that are important in order to kind of guarantee that safe passageway.
So what's going on right now? As of right now, can't domestic violence survivors visit police stations or hospitals that are more than 10 kilometers away? Are they not allowed to do so?
So as far as we understand, I think there's a lot, the purpose of putting out messages is so that people are confident and not scared to go out.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So when we don't have that clarity, there's a lot of hesitancy, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of confusion about what can and can't do, you know?
Right.
So so right now, it seems that the survivors are able to access. But for instance, like we had a survivor who wanted to go to a safe house that was located in a different district or beyond, definitely beyond the 10-kilometer boundary. And she was really, really, stressed about making the visit there, the journey there, you know, because she didn't have a travel pass. And there was a lot of difficulty in getting this travel pass, you know. So things like that. We want to make it as easy as possible for survivors to exit their abusive situations. So if there are little things like this, it can hamper and become an obstacle for survivors.
Yeah. So based on what, you know, the calls that you're getting and things like that, right? And the observations that y'all have made, let's say if there's a lack of clarity right now and people are unsure, you know, if they've been, you know, abused, whether they can go to the police station, whether, you know, whether they are allowed, whether there'll be a roadblock and they will be stopped. So what usually happens if there are loads of these kinds of concerns, what do the survivors usually do? Do they just end up staying at home and just facing it by themselves?
It depends on who they reach out to.
All right.
Yeah. So, I mean, if they reach out to us, WAO, we try as much as possible to engage with the authorities to try to ensure, you know, safe passageway and safe travels. But that's the most that we can do, and that's why that's why we are also asking the government to clearly outline what their SOPs are on this, so that we are also able to support and serve survivors the best we can.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go to WAO's final recommendation. What is your third recommendation?
All right, so our third recommendation is to ensure that public service announcements include the following. Firstly, a clear message that domestic violence is a crime. It's an act against the law, and that survivors can still access help during the lockdown, you know. Mm-hmm. So lockdown or not, it doesn't change this. That should be made clear, yeah. Second of all, a clear message that support and protection can still be accessed by survivors. Thirdly, if as I mentioned earlier, if there are any changes in terms of procedures to access support and protection, these need to be communicated, and including arrangements or exceptions that can be made for DV survivors to travel. Finally, we also want to emphasize that these public service announcements can, or rather, I also suggest that these PSAs can be done in a variety of ways in order for these messages to go out, to reach a larger and extended audience, Mm-hmm. So it could be, and these are some things that the government have done in the last year and this year. For instance, we did see last year and this year an SMS being issued out to the public, right, about how, the public can access Talian Kasih 15999 if they require assistance or if they are experiencing domestic violence, okay? Mm-hmm. And we also saw news articles or rather interviews with the police being featured in newspapers about domestic violence survivors being still able to lodge a police report during MCO. So these are really good examples of public service announcements that have been done. Mm-hmm. But I guess the point that we want to highlight is that with every MCO that happens, it has to be reiterated and it has to be made clear. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And it's great that these announcements are out, but we need to do more.
Hmm. Now, something interesting you brought up earlier, because we, like you said, we don't want to discount the government completely. They have taken certain steps, to manage the situation. But something you mentioned really struck a chord, which is, there should be clear messaging that domestic violence is a crime. Do you think that there has been a lack of clear and perhaps more specifically progressive messaging from the government to the public with regard to domestic violence and similar issues? When we look at last year, for example, the Ministry of Women and Family Development, they released this, sort of PSA on Instagram talking, about saying how women should, girl up manja Doraemon and things like that. This has happened under this government. Do you think that is a problem in terms of how it sort of inculcates a culture?
Yes, I do think that it is a problem. And, it's a culture of victim blaming.
Yep.
In a way. And we shouldn't be endorsing or encouraging this kind of culture in society. Certainly, I think this has a role, and the message that domestic violence is a crime, as you said, there's not enough of that message being circulated in public, and people still may not realize that it's a crime. It's a crime against the law.
Yeah, because in Malaysia, you hear this phrase used a lot, right? And let's say a husband and wife is arguing by the streets very loudly and it's getting heated up. People around, it's like, oh, that's a family matter, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think we do have that culture as well, right? Whatever happens in the house, just that's their problem.
Yeah. Yes, because like at the end of the day, at the root of violence or domestic violence, mm-hmm, or gender based violence is our attitudes and perceptions of towards gender, towards violence mm-hmm. and gender equality? Like, what do people think about women, and you know, how do they respect women? You know, these are the more basic and rather root causes of violence that we need to target. And public service announcements can go a long way in addressing these kinds of attitudes and problematic attitudes and perceptions.
All right. Shazana, as we wrap up this conversation, I want to perhaps end with, do you have advice to survivors who face domestic violence during this MCO? So we've talked about, you know, the problems they might run into, the lack of clarity, perhaps, things along those lines. So with that in mind, what advice to survivors would you have?
Yeah, first of all, if you are experiencing a situation of emergency, in the sense that you are physically being threatened and you need to escape the situation immediately, please call 999, the police, and they should be able to assist you in escaping your situation. If you prefer to talk things out to kind of understand, you know, your rights as a survivor, what your options are at this point of time, please contact WAO at 03-3000-8858. This is our WAO hotline, which is accessible 24 hours. Or you can WhatsApp or SMS 018-988-8058. And this is also accessible 24 hours. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these are two numbers that you can contact WAO. And it doesn't always have to be about, I want to lodge a police report now. You know what I mean? It could just be about understanding at this point what your rights are, what your options are. And it can just be as simple as that. It just takes, and sometimes this information can go a long way in helping you make your decisions. You can also call Talian Kasih at 15999, and they would also be able to advise you on the steps, on your next steps, and what you can do to seek help.
On that note, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Shazana.
Thank you, Darshan, for having me.
That was Shazana Akar, the head of research at WAO, and she was sharing some recommendations for the government on how they can help manage the rising number of domestic abuse cases during the latest lockdown. So if you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.